Thank you so much for joining me today. I am delighted to introduce you to our guest. You may have heard of him. You may know him. He is someone that we've been trying to get on this show for quite some time, and he has a very unique and interesting background, so I think you're going to really enjoy it. His name is Dan Harris. He's an internationally regarded as a leading authority on legal matters which are related to doing business in China and other countries and other emerging economies in Asia. He's been in Forbes magazine, Business Week, Fortune magazine, BBC News, and more. I could go on and on. He writes and speaks extensively on Chinese law, on international law. He works with a lot of companies who want to take their organizations internationally. He has offices in the U.S., Spain, China, and Mexico. And he is the kind of person that you go to when you're ready to take that next level and go into international work that you might be focusing on. So, Dan, with all of that, what did I miss today?
Absolutely nothing. That's my entire life in that 2 minutes.
I love it. That's perfect. Well, like I said, I felt like I did you no justice because there's so much more about you that we're going to get into. And something that's really interesting is that I had reached out to Dan months and months ago that we were just chatting about and on another matter, and come to find out, we have something very much in common. One of his children has had ADHD, and my son, as everyone knows, who is a co-founder of this company, was diagnosed with ADHD in the fifth grade, and I was diagnosed at age 45. Now, Dan is yet to be determined, so all of you psychiatrists out there, I'm just joking, Dan, but what I'm saying is that he can have a real good appreciation of that journey, and would you agree with that?
Yes, and my wife is a psychologist, so that also has helped a bit.
Wonderful. She'll be on the show next week as we talk more about Dan. No, I'm just joking on that. Anyway, so, well, first of all, Dan, as you know, I own three companies, and one of those is a 30-year executive search firm. And we always like to talk to people about, you know, first of all, how did you get on this journey? What brought you to this place? Because it's not every day that you find someone that is as specialized as you are. And so did you always know that you wanted to work, you know, with companies that were working in the international area? Or how did this go? And what made you want to be an attorney in the first place?
Well, I guess I would say that I've always known that I wanted to be an international attorney since I realized that I wasn't going to make it in the NBA.
Wait, tell us about that. So what did you...
No, I was not that great a basketball player. I just loved basketball and would play it 5 hours a day. But when I was... My father was a college professor, and 1 year I lived in France when he was on his sabbatical, and I spent my junior year of high school in Istanbul, Turkey. And it was while there that I realized that I enjoyed very much interacting with other cultures, and I enjoyed the excitement of the new. You go to a country like Turkey, and just walking the streets is fascinating. And that's when I knew I wanted to do international law.
Wow, that's great. You know, we work, our company, Refocus the Creative Office, we work a lot in the U.S. and we work internationally as well. And, you know, sometimes we hear not so great stories and then we hear better stories. But for our company, we have some really great relationships working with international companies. So it can be a very great partnerships that you have with international companies, creating things that might not have ever come, you know, to fruition. Would you agree with that?
100%. And a lot of times people, our clients included, will complain about a company in a foreign country as though it, the way they act is inherent to the people of that country. Well, usually the problems stem from miscommunication that is exacerbated by different cultures and different languages. And so we'll get an American company saying, oh, you know, I knew the people of this country were dishonest. But the reality is that we also represent foreign companies coming into the United States, and they have the exact same sorts of problems. So really, the issue is usually not that some country is made up of inherently bad companies. It's that anytime you cross borders, you're adding complications. And I think the biggest mistake people make is to assume that if someone speaks really good English, therefore they're exactly like you. And the reality is culture can be very strong also, and that can lead to a lot of miscommunications and a lot of problems when you don't realize that on sometimes even the most basic things.
Right. You know, and today it was interesting. I was speaking with a university and I was talking to their international department, and they were saying how a lot of companies, due to worrying about the legal matters of hiring even an intern that was an international student, that a lot of companies didn't want to do that. And I thought, you know, that's so sad because it's really not that hard. The university usually helps you with that. And it's usually, you know, if you want to hire that person further, that's another story. But there's some great students even in this country right now that are really creative, who could bring a lot of benefit to companies that might be looking for even interns.
That is so true. And I hate to say this, but there is prejudice against foreign law students who come to U.S. law schools, and they may do very well at the U.S. law school, but a lot of law firms and a lot of companies think that because they're from, let's say, Russia, that they should be doing international law, when in reality, that Russian student may have just graduated from a very good law school and focused on, let's say, something like intellectual property. And I feel like, in fact, I've seen it in action, that there is sort of a view that foreign-born law students are somehow not as qualified as American-born law students. And because of that, we tend to have a lot of foreign-born lawyers, many of whom are not even doing international law. And I feel like we get better lawyers that way because we're sort of arbitraging this mistake in the market.
I couldn't agree more, because I am on a mission to help change that. Actually, I went to, I had talked to a couple of different universities that were wanting to get students to do internships. And I asked them, I said, so what type of companies hire these international students? And they said, usually it's accounting firms and law firms. And I said, well, do these students, whether it be in law school or not, it might be just a regular, you know, liberal arts school or a major university, and they may be marketing may be their major. And I said to them, I said, so what if they don't want to be an accountant or be an attorney? And they said, well, that's kind of the breakdown. It's a very sad situation. And so we at our company have made an admission that, you know, we are going to start speaking with international departments and seeing if there's any interest, because we want to do our part. So first of all, if you're listening to this and you have a company or you have a department, really don't shy away from that. I would encourage you to talk to the administration, because the university will actually end up doing most of the work for you.
Well, call me old-fashioned, but I am one of those who truly believes that having a diverse workforce is powerful. And I remember attending an event at which Brad Smith, who I think was a senior VP at Microsoft at the time, talked about how Microsoft's big advantage in the world is that he can walk down the hall and pull together five Ethiopians, let's say, to work on a project involving Ethiopia. And that's something that the United States has always had. And people don't realize how much that gives us an advantage over a country like China, which is a country I deal with all the time. Chinese companies have virtually no diversity. They're almost all Chinese. They might have a few token Americans or Europeans, but those Americans and Europeans are rarely taken seriously for anything.
Oh, wow.
And how are you going to be an international company without being international internally?
Exactly. And we are a woman-owned diversified company via certified through WeBank. And I know for a fact we've had a woman who's worked for us for years from Korea who lives in the US now, but we also have someone in Chicago, someone in California. We have somebody that works for us in Pakistan and one in Serbia. And these are some of our best employees. So again, I'm with you on that. And thank you for sharing that, because I think that's really crucial to advancing our country to being more global, and also to getting to that peaceful level of, hey, these are people too, right? They work every day just like we do. And we are very, very fortunate in our country for some of the things that they don't have. So it's, I always say, always have an open mind, because you never know what that person's talents are going to bring to your company.
Absolutely.
So tell me, so going forward, so we were talking a little bit about ADHD, and this company is all about focus. And so we're going to get to your ADHD connection in a moment, but talk to us a little bit about focusing. So for you, you know, you and I joked before that you said, you know, I'm probably ADD and I didn't know it. And my husband says the same thing, and he's like, I don't know it. But, you know, I think as we get older and even more experienced in our career, that we put more and more work onto ourselves, right? So this, our company is not just for individuals with ADHD, it's for anyone who wants to focus and who wants to be more productive. So for you, you know, on a day-to-day basis, do you find yourself not being able to focus? And how do you do it? Like, just even on a day-to-day basis, because you may be working remotely, you may be working from the office, but what is your trick that seems to work
well
for you?
I'm not sure I have a trick. What I am incredibly good at focusing on things on which I need to focus. And what I mean by that is, and I was thinking about this before the show, is that I can be in my office, although right now I'm at my house, I can be in my office at work, working on something, and someone will come in and say, this construction noise is bothering me so much, I'm just going to go home and work from there. And all of a sudden, I'll realize that there's construction noise. And I think, I mean, that is actually a sign of ADD, is the ability to hyper-focus. I can work anywhere. I can, if I need to do a two-page memo at a basketball game, I can do it. And basically, things go silent for me when I'm hyper-focusing. And so, even just yesterday, I was planning to go for a walk at about 3 or 4 in the afternoon. And I came down at 6:15 to go for that walk, thinking it was 3 or 4, and learned it was 6:15. And we were going to be eating dinner soon. So if I can hyper-focus, but I can only hyper-focus on those things that really matter. If something doesn't matter, if I'm not interested in it, I cannot focus at all. And so what I tend to do, and this is the luxury of being a very senior lawyer, I tend to give it to other people to do, because it can be almost right. Hopeless. Now, a story I always tell is, and this has to be an ADHD story, I tend to get bored. Sometimes if somebody will be at my house and I'm bored and it's 10:30, I might, without thinking, just announce that I have to go to bed. And that sort of irritates people. So I have to sort of train myself not to do that. But I was at the Asia China Film Festival or something like that in Los Angeles. And I went to a movie that was put on by one of our clients. And I'm sitting in the movie, and I'm not going to name names. It was a Chinese movie. And about 15 minutes into it, I decided it was one of the worst movies I had ever seen. And it was. And I was sitting in that chair for the next hour and 20 minutes, feeling almost like I was on pins and needles. I could not stand it because I didn't know whether to leave. I kept thinking, I'm wasting my life. I'm wasting an hour of my time on this. But I was afraid to leave because it was a client movie and people would have seen that I had got up and left. So I sat there through the whole movie and it was absolutely horrible. And people without ADHD probably think I'm exaggerating, but I can still, I almost break out in a sweat thinking about that. So when it's something that I don't want to focus on, I can't. And if I'm forced to, it causes problems.
Absolutely. You know, my son, I've noticed that throughout the years, is that if there's something he's interested in, and I'll give an example, if he can see a car on the road, he knows exactly what year it is, what make, what model, if it's had a paint job on it. I mean, from a distance, and it just blows my mind because people with ADHD are some of the most brilliant people that I've ever met. And they've got a lot of different talents. And now he's working almost full time in college studying IT engineering. And I'm thinking, how are you doing this? But he's busy and he's busy with something that he loves doing. And so that's half the battle. And if you make him sit during an event of something that he's bored, he's tapping, he's going crazy, he can't stand it. So that makes total sense to me. And so you're right. And so if there's any advice to those individuals that don't have the luxury of giving that to someone, what do you do to get through it? Do you, because a lot of people will do, they'll have rings that like spin, they'll have a rubber band, they'll have different things that will kind of do that. Do you use any of those type of things to help you?
Well, when I'm on the phone with someone, I'll be doodling, I'll be drawing faces or whatever. Mm-hmm. But really a lot of what I do is, and I learned this from my father, who in hindsight, he was a college professor. He no doubt had ADHD also. You need to basically just admit that you have problems with certain things. Like I would go to the store and my mother would say, can you get me these three items? And I'd go to the store and I'd come back with a Reese's peanut butter cup. That's for me. So I had to start realizing, wait a second, I can't just act like there are no issues here. So I've trained myself on certain things. When I get up in the morning, the first thing I do is check my calendar. I also try to check it the night before. And then I set alarms.
Right.
Because if I don't set an alarm, there's a chance I will miss it. And a lot of times what I'll miss is, let's say I know I have an 11 o'clock appointment, so I'll set my alarm for 10:55 to remind me to get ready for the 11 o'clock appointment. Sometimes at 10:55, I'll go, okay, I've got 5 minutes, and then I'll go off and do something. And then I'll look up 30 minutes later and realize that I'm 25 minutes late for my 11 o'clock meeting. So now what I do is I set the alarm for 10:55. I set it for 10:58 and I set it for 10:59.
Actually, that's more common. I do that myself. And I think a lot of people do that as well. And, you know, I always say, do what works for you, you know, find out what works for you. And the interesting thing too, as I was reading your background the other day, and I was thinking, you even do public speaking, right, to large audiences. Do you ever get stage fright or do you get anxiety or anything? And the other thing is, how do you focus when you're getting ready to talk in front of a crowd?
I've never been that afraid of that. And one of the things I've done is I realized that I'm speaking in front of 100 people. They're there to enjoy themselves. They're there in a strange sort of way, even though they don't know me, they're there to support me because they want me to give a good speech. Nobody is there to watch Dan Harris mess up. So that gives me comfort. So I think about that. But what I've also learned in giving talks is that nobody knows what I'm talking about. And what I mean by that is that when I first started giving talks, I would have, 10 pages of notes, and I would look at them a lot. And it was the same. I used to go to court. I don't go to court anymore, but I would go to court and I'd have, 10 pages of notes. Well, what I learned was that I'm better off with no notes, and maybe I'll miss a section of my speech. Maybe I'll forget to tell a particular story. But overall, the speech is better. And that's what I mean by nobody knows what my speech is about. I can give an hour-long speech, and after I'm done, I'll say, oh, shoot, I forgot to give this perfect story. Well, the speech overall was better without the perfect story and me just talking without looking at notes than it would have been if I had included the perfect story and had my notes. I was much more animated. I can tell jokes. I can make mistakes and tell jokes about my mistakes. The more you do things, one of my favorite books is by Malcolm Gladwell, and it's not Blink, it's 10, I forget which one it is, but he talks about 10,000 hours. And if you do something a lot, you get good at it. And I speak all the time and I'm comfortable with it. And I'm not a world-class orator, but I'm comfortable and I'm satisfied with how I do. And so I'm usually not terribly afraid. I'm only afraid when I have to talk about something where I have no clue. I had a lawyer mentor who told me, he said, when I go into the court, I assume I am not going to be the most charismatic person in there, and there's nothing I can do about it. But I found that when I go in incredibly well prepared, I actually feel pretty charismatic. And by being comfortable, I am more charismatic. So right. I guess my secret weapon is preparation. That's everybody's secret weapon. If you know what you're going to be talking about, you can talk about it for a long, long time. If you don't know, then it can be scary. And sometimes as a lawyer, we have to talk about things we don't know that well, meaning I might go off and meet with a client expecting that, I prepared to talk about intellectual property in Mexico, and all of a sudden he says, well, we don't want to talk about Mexico. We've decided we're going into Argentina.
Right.
I have to start talking about Argentina, and I don't know Argentina as well as Mexico because I didn't prepare for it. So a lot of times I just say, look, this is how I think it is in Argentina. I'm not our Argentinian expert. When I get back to the office, I'll double check on this or something like that. You learn sort of to wing it a bit.
Right. And you always, and most attorneys I know will always say, if that's not my area, let me find you somebody that does, or, at least put you in the right direction. Absolutely. And, which is really good. So I have a big question for you on this. So let's talk about attorneys for a second in general, because, when a lot of people, especially who are in business and they want to go to an attorney, there's somebody, either the CFO, the COO, the CEO, that gets a little nervous, and they feel like they shouldn't. And I always say that's one of the biggest mistakes that you can do, because in my opinion, the two most important things when you start a business is having an excellent attorney and an excellent CPA. Those are the two areas that you really need to have your ducks in a row when you're going into business. But for those individuals who, let's say they're afraid to do that, so I always say, when you talk about being prepared, I say be prepared before you talk to that attorney. Have your questions written down and ready to go. So what is it that attorneys wish that their clients would do before they meet with them?
Gather up the facts.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Because a lot of times somebody will ask me a question. Like the other day, I got an email where somebody said, are you familiar with the rules for Made in China? And my answer was, the rules for made in China in what country for what products. And we went back and forth with emails where I kept asking questions and didn't know what this person was talking about. And then finally, they revealed that they have a product that they have made in China that they want to sell to the Chinese government, and they want to look like they are a Chinese company. And I said, okay, well, we can help you. And I'm thinking, that is a completely different question than the one you asked. And so what people should do is they should go to their lawyers with the facts and with the big issues, and not try to sort of play lawyer before they go to the lawyer. Because half the time, companies, when they come to us, think they have an A problem and they have a B problem. And they've defined it as an A problem. So we talk to them about problem A for 15 minutes before we realize that's not their problem at all. Right. It's sort of like the doctor. These days, everything's on the internet. So I think that when I go to the doctor, it's like I did this once. And I went to the doctor and I said, yeah, I think I'm coming because my family's making me come. You know, I'm pretty convinced I just have a cold. And she ran some tests. She goes, no, you have the flu. Well, she knows a lot better than I do. She's a doctor. I'm not.
Right.
And so I think that just coming in as though you know the problem and the solution is, that's fine. But it's more important that you come in with the facts and with the issues you have and the goals you have. The other thing that's important is that you go see the lawyer at the right time. We often joke, and lawyers often say this, our best clients are the ones who have been burned. And the ones who get burned are the ones who could have paid $3,000 to have a good contract, but they didn't. And now they're involved in litigation that's going to cost them $300,000. That company's not going to make that mistake again. But we see it a lot. People are too afraid of lawyers. And lawyers are definitely at large fault for that. Lawyers love to talk in their own language to sort of distance themselves, et cetera. But the reality is a lot of things that protect you are cheap. Once you have a problem, it is almost always going to be incredibly expensive. And you should not be afraid to ask your lawyer how much it's going to cost.
Right.
And if your lawyer cannot flat fee it or give you a pretty good estimate, then there could very well be a problem there. So for instance, people can come to us and say, I need a manufacturing contract for Pakistan, and we will quote them a flat fee because we've done so many international manufacturing contracts. We know that they're going to cost, you know, within 10% of this number, and we're going to flat fee it for people. And sometimes people will say, well, how are you able to do that? I spoke with someone and they told me they didn't know what it would cost. It could cost anywhere from $5,000 to $20,000. And my answer is, well, if they're saying that, they must not have done that many. Now, there are times where you don't know, and those are usually when you already have a problem, like litigation. If somebody's being sued, you can say to them, well, you know, this could cost $10,000 or $1 million. And they'll say, you're kidding, right? And you go, no, it just depends on whether we can settle it. If we can settle it within 2 weeks, it's not going to cost anything much. But it could go 3 years with 60 depositions around the country. We don't know. We cannot predict how it's going to go because we don't know what the other side's going to do, and we don't know what the court's going to do. But writing a contract, filing a trademark, drafting a licensing agreement, those things you should be using a lawyer who has done that so many times that they can give you a really clear idea, if not a flat fee, as to what it's going to cost.
Yeah, absolutely. And I agree with that. The I did want to talk about international countries for a moment, because one of the questions that we get, a lot of our listeners will write to us and say, you know, can you ask your guests more about failure? You know, because a lot of people have experienced failure, but some have come out of it great, and some of them have not. And so I think people really want to know sometimes, you know, has somebody like you that is so well known, have you ever faced any kind of failure? How did you get through it? Number one. And then number two, if you have a client that comes to you and let's say that, you know, there's no way that they can fight this. There's no way they can settle. And it may push them off into bankruptcy. Who knows, right? But how do they get through that? Have you ever experienced that? And do you have any advice for people? Because I think, you know, we all have a journey, and it's how we respond to it. And so knowledge, the old saying, knowledge is power, is so true. But have you ever experienced that in your own life?
And I did not know you were going to ask this question, but I love the question. The reason I love the question is because I sat next to the person who founded Reebok. I sat next to that person on an airplane, and he told me that before Reebok, he had filed bankruptcy, I think, 3 or 4 times. And he talked about how failure is irrelevant, that if you're going to succeed, you have to fail. And when we hire people at our law firm, I love telling a story of how we hired somebody and she went off to get business cards. And she came back and it was maybe $150 worth of business cards. And she said, here are the cards. And I looked at them and she goes, these are not really the right color, are they?
Oh, no.
I jokingly said, well, they're sort of the right color. I mean, they're, you know, one is gray, the other's white, one is red, the other's burgundy. And I kept joking about these various things. The cards were terrible. They were not close to what they should have been. And she was very apologetic. And I said to her, I said, look, you've been with us about a month now. You've had to make about 15 decisions. All of them were good except this one. And there's no reason to think that anyone else would have made a better decision on this than you. It's not like we have anybody in our law firm who is an expert on business cards. I would, without any thought, Trey, if you had come to me on those other 15 decisions and made me spend 10 minutes working with you on making the decisions, and then you had gotten all 15 right instead of 14, it would have cost us way more money to do it that way in my time. The reality is you made 15 decisions. You turned out to have been wrong on one of them that anyone could have been wrong on. Keep making the decisions. Do not worry about mistakes. And I got that actually from SAS, the airline, which would give an award to the employee. It was like $500 to the employee who made the biggest mistake each month, because they were of the view that if you weren't making mistakes, you weren't really doing anything. So mistakes are going to happen. I always say, you know, you strive for perfection, because if you don't strive for perfection, you'll never get it. But you're going to make mistakes. You look at them, you analyze them, you don't beat yourself over the head for it. You try, you learn from it, you move on. That's how I view failure. And I've talked a lot about this with my kids. One of the other things about failure is when I hear people talk about what they regretted, it's things like, you know, I regret quitting the football team in 10th grade, because that's the kind of regret people have, because they don't know what they could have done. But people say to me, they say, my older brother is a terrific musician. So people will say, well, you must have been a really good musician also. And I'll go, no, I wasn't. And they'll go, oh, come on, you're just saying that. I'll go, no, I wasn't. I tried very hard. I wasn't. And I actually take comfort from that. There's no doubt in my mind that I could not have become a good musician. I'm over with it. I'm done with it. That makes me feel better than if I had had amazing potential and failed because I quit. It's failure is, to me, the definition of failure is not trying. It's not failing. It's, I mean, I hate to keep going, well, I hate to bring up sports because I feel like we've talked about it, but I think we talked about it a little bit before. But both my kids played sports. I love sports. I think sports helps teach you about failure. If you play baseball, you're going to make an out 7 out of 10 times. If you play basketball, you're going to miss your shot half the time. And if you sit there and pout about missing a shot, then you're not ready for the next play. You just have to move on. And that's how life is.
That's right. So that is exactly right. And you know, you and I have spoke before about this, is that, you know, we had a situation several years ago that we did an international product and we lost $25,000, and my entire staff was more devastated than I was. And I remember saying to them, look, we lost 25,000, but it wasn't 25 million. And if we're building this company, I need you to be focused on the bigger picture. So we need to learn from it, move on, and, you know, recoup our losses here. And it was so funny because a lot of them really had such a hard time because they said, I would be just devastated. And I said, of course you would. But I said, but at this point, we know what we have to do. We know how we have to fix this, and we know how we won't be using that supplier in the future. But again, it's how you look at things. So I really appreciate that example that you gave, because a lot of people can get stuck. They get stuck into that and they carry it for years. And I always say you have to keep going forward.
Well, look at your business. You have 30 some products.
Yeah.
I'm sure you've had products. I mean, you don't introduce a product without believing that it's going to be good and sell. But I'm sure you've had a product where you were completely wrong and it didn't sell and it wasn't a good product. But you know what? Who cares? What matters is that you have 30 good products.
Right.
Not you had a product that you decided to axe after 3 months. If you're going to get 30 good products, you're going to get 5 bad products along the way. And you can't stop that. And you've just got to excise them and also have the guts to say, hey, this isn't working. This product, I'm pulling it.
Right. Exactly. And know when to pull. Have you ever had to have those conversations with clients where you say, listen, I think you should stop this, or I think you should go a different direction. I've had early, like I think 20 years ago, I had an attorney say that to me and we did, and it was the best advice I ever got. So have you had to have those conversations?
We have those conversations all the time.
Really?
And what I have to do is gird our lawyers for those, because a lot of times we have to say to the client, look, what you've done, you're planning to do X, that is never going to work. And in fact, you have a problem that you do not even know you have. So the first thing we have to do before we even talk about your options is fix the problem. And what's interesting is I believe in being completely honest with clients. I don't have time not to be. I can't remember what I tell everybody. The easiest thing is to be honest. Mm. I would say 95% of all companies want you to give them the straight story, whether it's good or bad. And there are some, and usually those are not very successful people or companies, that get mad at you for telling them the truth. And my view about those clients is we don't want them.
Right.
We just don't want them, because if they're going to do stupid things and not listen to us, I mean, we've had clients who haven't listened to us because they've said, look, I get what you're saying here. But it's more important for us that we have, let's say, the same agreement everywhere in the world than that we have a perfect agreement for Sri Lanka. Then I can say, okay, I get it. I understand your position. You understand mine. You know your business better than me. I'm totally fine with it.
Right.
But the client's going to get mad at me for saying, look, you do realize that if we make this contract for Sri Lanka the same as the contracts you use for Europe, it's not going to be as strong as it could be for Sri Lanka. And they get mad at me for saying that, then I really don't want to work with them because they're dangerous, because they're going to cause us to not do our best work and we're going to fall with them.
Right.
But most companies do not, they want that information. I mean, I always joke with the lawyers in my firm, I love it when a younger lawyer says, Dan, I think you're wrong about this. I mean, I don't care whether they're right or wrong. I love it that they say that. Now, of course, they're always wrong.
No, yeah, you got to give them credit for that. Absolutely, you know, yeah.
I give them credit because even if they're right only one time out of 10, they just helped me that one time look better and do better.
Yeah.
And that's all that people should be concerned about.
We are all a work in progress. We're all a work in progress. Even someone that's been in business for 30 years. I always say that as well. So that's great. So talk to me about what's it like, you've got children. We were talking about that. What's it like raising a child with ADHD? Because I know what it's like and you know what it's like, but how has it been, what advice on helping them focus? I mean, anything that you've done in your life, you know, that helped them along the way? Because I always say with this podcast, it's all about focus. And while you're thinking of that, I'll just share recently, my son, we had a holiday party and we were going around in our company and each person got a question. And it was, they had to answer it. And so his was, what was the best advice your mother ever gave you? And he's a co-founder in the company. And I'm thinking, oh, of all cards, and that's the one he gets, right? And he said, he was a child actor. And he said, the best advice my mom ever gave me was we would go to a child or an audition when he was a child actor. And afterwards, I would have him rip his script up and we would never talk about it because I didn't want him to face rejection. And who knew that he's kept that throughout his life? I never knew it. And he kept that throughout these years. And so things work for different kids. So if you've got any advice on what worked well with helping your child, one of your children, focus, or any of them, we'd love to know it.
Wow, that's a tough question. Especially since my eldest, and she would be the first to tell you this, was in a lot of respects, almost the perfect kid. Mm. She was the kid who never did anything wrong. She was a basketball star, and we never, literally, never once had to tell her to study.
Wow.
She was our eldest. We thought we knew exactly what we were doing, and then our second came along, and our second was super smart, super creative, and just didn't care that much about school. Mm. And would just tell us, look, I don't care about my grades in middle school. My grades don't matter until high school. And there's truth to that. They yeah. really don't. But what I would have to say is, well, that is true, but if you're going to get good grades in high school, you have to learn how to get them in middle school. And so we were constantly having to try to push her, and she couldn't really be pushed. I mean, it's interesting because their personalities were so different. I remember when our youngest came in and made a sandwich at about 8 years old, I said, wow, that's really impressive. I don't know when, and then the name of her eldest. I don't know when, how old our eldest was when she first made a sandwich for herself. And then I go, actually, I don't think she's ever made a sandwich for herself. So our youngest was very independent and strong. And we just did not have that much influence on her. But she kept saying, you know, when I go to college, I'm going to get serious. I'm going to study what I want, et cetera. And she went off to a very good school and did extremely well and is now an adult with a very good job that she loves. And she's going to be taking the LSAT this weekend because for some reason she wants to be a lawyer, although she makes very clear that she wants to be a very different kind of lawyer than her father. But I think that the lesson from all of that is that every kid is different. The way you treat them has to be different. And you cannot get frustrated with the fact that you're not having as much impact on them as you would like. As my wife would always say, you focus on turning them into good, happy people. And if you can do that, everything else is gravy. But I think if you can do that, the gravy, there'll be a lot of gravy because your kids will feel good about themselves and succeed. And one of the other things, though, that we always had with both of our kids is that once you start something and commit to, let's say, your friends, you cannot quit. Meaning, if you decide that you don't want to take the clarinet anymore, that's fine. If you've really thought it through. But if you're on a soccer team and the season's not going the way everyone likes and there are three games left, you're not going to quit now because you're going to be, it's not fair to your teammates. And so it's not, I don't believe in forcing kids to do much, but I do believe in forcing kids to live up to their responsibilities. Meaning, if you're going to get a dog and say you're going to walk the dog every day, you better do it.
Right. Absolutely. And you feed the talent. You know, just like with my son, when he was a child actor, there was a point where he didn't want to do it anymore. And I said, you know what, let's go play ball. Let's go do something. Let's, you know, you feed the talent and you follow with them because you're exactly right. At the end of the day, all we want is for them to really have peace inside and to be happy and to have a great life. That's really all we want. We can push them every single day, but at the end of the day, that's truly what most parents want for their children.
Well, and they have to pursue their own interests, mm-hmm. meaning that my eldest was a basketball star. I love that. I love basketball. My youngest, I felt, could have been a basketball star. She one day decides she wants to do dance. And I'm sitting there thinking, dance? What do I know about dance? Well, she did dance. She loved it. I came to love it. I viewed it as similar to basketball. It teaches you the same things. The more you work, the better you get. The more you practice, the better you get. You're performing in front of people. You make a mistake. They don't even notice. Or they do notice and you have to keep going.
That's
right.
It's
the same sort of thing. You want your kid. And my wife would always say this. We want them to have a passion for something other than watching TV and playing video games. It doesn't matter what it is. It's got to be their choice.
Right, exactly. And so, you know, so you've got a wide variety of interest with your children, you know, and, you know, whether most parents, what we found is that some find that they're later in life, they're diagnosed, like myself, with ADD, ADHD. But let's say that you may or may not be that, but you might have the tendencies for that. For you, because we've talked a little bit about this, is the legal profession, is that a good profession for someone with that? And I know that's a big question, or has it been challenging and difficult? Because with any type of ADD and ADHD, with any type of legal work, it takes a lot of focus and a lot of attention.
Well, that's a great question. And the answer is the answer lawyers love to give, which is yes and no.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, of course.
But truth is that lawyers are a strange bunch. And I don't think people understand the personality of lawyers all that well. because I think people think that lawyers tend to be extroverts because we talk all the time. But in reality, most lawyers are not terribly good socially. We're nerds. We are people. What I always say is we got a 4.0 in high school. We got a 3.8 in college. We got a 3.6 in law school. And we go out into the world saying, I just graduated from XYZ law school in the top 10%. And just sort of expecting everything to follow from that. And it doesn't, because nobody really cares. They don't care about that stuff. The client is like, okay, that's great. Now, can you help me figure out how I can have my product manufactured in Guatemala and shipped to France?
Right, exactly.
About anything else. Okay, so you have to deal with that reality. But lawyers tend to be people who, we're bookish people. We read a ton, we write a lot. And in that respect, ADHD can be quite good, because I can sit down and write, you know, I can read something for 8 hours and then write spend 5 hours writing a memo, and it's sort of nothing to me. So in that respect, it's easy. What's difficult is managing 20 different things at once, mm-hmm. which ADHD people are not terribly good at. Mm-hmm. It's like, whoa, I just got this memo out, but I was supposed to call a client at 4 o'clock and it's now 7 o'clock. Mm-hmm. So you have to be organized. You have to be hyper-organized. And that is hard. Mm-hmm. But there are helps out there. There are helps with calendaring. There's helps with people with paralegals who you put in charge of the calendar on a particular project, et cetera. So I think being a lawyer is actually a very good profession for people with ADHD. Now, I had a friend who was a lawyer at my old law firm, and he had ADHD worse than just about any human being I've ever seen. And sometimes I'd be talking to him and I'd say, hey, look, you know, we need to do, and then all of a sudden he would jump up, literally jump up. He'd go, I got to go. I just remembered I need to make a call.
Yeah.
And he was so easily diverted that he was having trouble practicing law. He ended up becoming a stockbroker and becoming a huge, huge success as a stockbroker, because he talks with people all the time. He's super, that's half of it. He's personable. And then the other half is digging into the financial stuff, which he can do. He doesn't have to deal with deadlines. So, I mean, if you have it really bad, it might be difficult.
Yeah.
But I can't speak for having ADHD in other professions, but I joke that it's a superpower for me, because I feel like I have, even at my advanced age, I have a ton of energy. I get very excited about things in a good way, and I'm happy to throw myself into a 9-hour project.
I love that. I love that. First of all, I could talk to you forever, Dan. I find you so interesting and so fascinating. But I got 3 questions for you. The first one is this. So, because as a search or recruiter, I get this asked to me all the time. But there's a lot of people who go to law school and they, you know, get into the law firm, and then usually I get the phone call about 10 years into it, and they say, you know what? I went to law school, but I really don't want to do this. I don't want to be, this is just not me. What do you think I should do? And so 2 questions around that with ADD. What makes a good second career, if you know, for people who wanted to go, who went to law school, but maybe it didn't cut it being an attorney?
Well, there are a lot of people who go to law school with no intention of ever becoming an attorney.
Mm-hmm.
And then they don't. They go to work for a company that deals with regulations. They start their own company. They do consulting work, et cetera. A lot of people like that. Mm-hmm. Those seem to be the natural paths for people who were lawyers. But what I see a lot of in the legal profession is people who hate being a lawyer and still keep doing it.
I know, and yeah. Mm-hmm.
They do it because they claim they can't do anything else. They have a mortgage, et cetera. And yet they complain all the time. And those people are downers, and I don't really like being around them.
Right.
Because they can do something. They're just something else. They just don't really want it enough, and they're willing to just sort of suffer. And people who are suffering in a job tend not to be that good at it either.
Oh, yeah. And I always say, you know, change it. You can change today and you can make right. a change today. And one of the professions that I hear a lot of legal people that will go into that are very good at it once they do it is in the HR field, because HR field can always use really great attorneys. So that's another area. And I could go on and on about that.
The field of law is humongous, meaning you can be somebody in the back room who does nothing but study and help clients with pension plans. Or you could be somebody who is in court every single day. I mean, there's just a huge variety. And so if you're the first thing you should do if you're unhappy as a lawyer is look at what you enjoy doing, what you don't enjoy doing, and start migrating to a legal area that has a lot more of what you enjoy and a lot less of what you don't. And it's very possible to do that.
Absolutely. And that's great advice. So who inspires you? Doesn't have to be any type of person or a specific person, but just overall in life, who inspires you to want to be better and to do better?
Great leaders who put their country above themselves. And somebody like Nelson Mandela, who could have held on to power if he had wanted to, but chose not to. Somebody like Lech Walesa in Poland, who was the same way. Havel, I can't think of his first name, in Czechoslovakia. Mm-hmm. People like that inspire me because they did great things and yet they were willing to step aside instead of hanging on. It's a very rare trait to be that way. Too many leaders in the world, let's say they get independence for their country and they did a great job at that. But then they don't want to ever relinquish power. It's very difficult to know what your role should be, in those circumstances. And I'm just in awe of those people who can make radical changes. I'm in awe of companies that can make changes. I'm from Michigan. And when I moved out to Seattle, people would say things like, wow, those, you know, General Motors, they're so stupid. They need to do this, this, and this. And I would say, mm-hmm. Look at General Motors, though. For 50 years, they did everything right. That makes it very hard to switch. And that's the problem. Once you have succeeded for 50 years, and then everything has changed around you, making the switch. It's very, very difficult to do that. So you get a company like Kodak that was great at film, but they never really switched. And so I'm fascinated by that because we're a law firm that does international work. We used to, our biggest country, our biggest work, believe it or not, used to be Russia. And then Russia basically disappeared. Now our biggest country is China, and China is going to disappear. Now, China is not going to disappear, and Russia didn't disappear, but business between Americans and Europeans in China is on the decline, and it's going to keep declining. And So we're having to start doing more with other countries. And it's that pivot that's so difficult. And nobody wants to pivot until the last minute. But in reality, you need to pivot before you need to pivot.
Love it. That is such great advice and such great role models. So thank you for sharing that. So my last question is this, and like I said, I'd love to have you back on our show because I know that we can, between you and I know we could talk about a million different things. But right now in your life, let's say you have to go to that really important meeting or you've got to really have game on and have it together. And maybe it's a day that you're just not yourself or, you know, we're all human, right? And we all get frazzled. So let's say it's just one of those days and you've got to get game on. When you get in your car and you go to that meeting, what is the music or the artist or the song that you listen to that brings that and gets you back to being where you've got game on for that meeting?
Go to the bio on my website. Bruce Springsteen, Born to Run. Oh, someday, girl, I don't know when we're gonna get to that place. But we really wanna go and we'll walk in the sun. But till then, chance like us, maybe we were born to run. Oh, honey, chance like us, maybe we were born to run. Come on with me, chance like us, maybe we were born to run.
Born to run. Okay, I'm just going to say this for our amazing producer. Bruce Springsteen was on the back of his wall when I interviewed him on doing our podcast. So he's going to love this. So that is fantastic. Have you seen him in concert? I'm sure you have.
I saw him in concert in Ames, Iowa for the first time. And my seats were so bad that it was to the back of the stage. But he was so good that I felt like almost as though he knew I was there.
I love that. I love that. Oh, that's
many times since then, but the first one was definitely the best, despite that, the terrible, terrible seats.
That is great. That's a great song. So first of all, thank you. Well, like I said, and we will put more information about Dan on our website, which is refocuswithangela.com, our website to our company where you can find out about products that are all created through the eyes of a child with ADHD. The products that help you focus is time2refocus.com. So Dan, thank you so much, so graciously for taking the time to speak with us. I know you're busy and I really appreciate your time. I think you are going to be an amazing guest for many people to listen to over and over again.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
This podcast has been brought to you by Refocus the Creative Office. Follow us on social media. You can find us on Twitter, on Instagram, on YouTube, just about anywhere. We have so much going on and we've got 4 new products coming out. So you'll want to stay tuned. Also, some of the new episodes that are coming out on the podcast are going to be amazing. Really, really unique individuals that they are definitely people that you will want to learn how they focus and how they refocus. Have a great week.